you know, say they're leaving and then they plan to come back, and it was could sometimes be confusing to the facility whether they were leaving or not. So it's been changed that if the provider has indicated in writing the intent that they're not coming back, that they can't charge them for more than 7 days after they've left. Section 7 was rewritten on chemical and physical restraints, that these can be used only after considering all other alternatives and pursuant to a physician's order or a Christian Science practitioner. If you remember in the hearing, we had some discussion about the Christian Science homes. And we also had some discussion about the Oregon State Board of Nursing rules. And those have been written in. We have current existing rules that we would just write in the reference to statute. To bring your attention on line 14, on page 3, one of the provider groups believes that the language here is too punitive. It says for the convenience of the adult foster home, and has suggested that that be softened. Restraints may not be used for discipline of a residence or for the convenience of the adult foster home. On page 4, this refers to non-ambulatory residents, that they shall not be given first floor rooms. Again, these sections were not changed as a result of the first hearing, because there just wasn't, in terms of the testimony and what the group thought, there wasn't, you know, a concern on these areas. On line 17, there was, however, considerable discussion about the notice that the resident must get in terms of that they must have notice at least 30 days prior to a proposed transfer or discharge. And originally it said except in a medical emergency. And it has been changed that also if the resident experiences a sudden increase in level of care needs or behavior which poses an imminent danger to self or others. But there would be an appeal. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just a,
yes,
a question about that imminent danger to self or others. Would that be, for example, a person's a care provider, foster home provider, mm-hmm. and they feel like this person's needs exceed their ability? I don't know.
The sudden increase in level of care needs is what, right. There is a question.
Oh, okay, it's or. Yeah, excuse or, me, I did not read or. It correctly. Thank
it's
you.
Or. And there is a question here in this change. Does the foster care home have the provider have the final say here in terms of what's behavior? Because we all know that can be subject to interpretation. There is an administrative hearing procedure, but I would point that out as an area where there is some... still might need to be some discussion.
How long does it take to get such a thing?
The hearing?
Uh-huh. Somebody from SBS.
Somebody in terms of a hearing?
Ms. Ditchie, would you come up and if you
prior to an yeah. Mm-hmm.
The question is, how long does it take to get a hearing?
The issue was how long would it take to get a hearing if you were being
involuntary? Yeah, involuntary.
Involuntary transfer.
Under Section 3 of the proposed bill, there is if they were found that there was a sudden increase in the level of care needs or the behavior poses an imminent danger to self or others, assuming that the foster home made that accusation and the resident did not agree with it, and they asked for a hearing under the next provision of the bill, how long would it take to get such a hearing?
Since we don't do that, we don't have experience with how long it would take. If someone is being evicted and asked for a hearing in a nursing home, which would be similar to that, the resident remains in the facility until they have the hearing, and usually it's, you know, as quickly as we can do that. That's a transfer hearing.
How long is it in nursing homes?
Probably 10 to 30 days, maybe less. Maybe these nursing home people back here know how long it takes to have a hearing on an eviction.
Well, I got a head nod on your numbers. So.
Right. The issue would be that, in fact, if someone can't take care of someone, and someone's in danger, you need to try to transfer the resident to get a bit more care.
Mr.
Chair.
Yes, Senator Phillips.
For the record, she might want to put on her name and who she is on the record.
Yes, that is true.
My name is Susan Deechee, Senior and Disabled Services Division.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Petrillo.
What we're providing here in this this provision is that the providers can give written notice if they're going to transfer or discharge, except in a medical emergency, or if the resident experiences a sudden increase in level of care needs. Is that, that would be so subject, I think, to interpretation. Is that the best language for that we could have?
Senator Tro, that was the language that the group working agreed was the most...
Was the best.
Was
okay, and I'm sure you considered a lot of other things.
We considered a number of other options.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Just seems like that's the provider, what's a sudden increase to the provider, you know, may not seem that way to somebody
right.
else.
Generally, anytime one's going to be evicted or transferred and there's either danger or a sudden onset of a change of level, it means that that person has to go somewhere also. Generally, and a person has to consent to where they're going. These are occasions where if someone has to go someplace and they don't want to go, we sometimes need to get an emergency guardian. Again, for short term, you know, not for permanent.
So that language really describes something.
So it's a process. You also have to have a place for that person to go that can provide the appropriate kind of service. As a last resort, it could be a commitment, either a hospital commitment, state hospital commitment, or,
okay.
you know, admission to another acute care.
Senator Kinnaman has.
Thank you. Ms. Deechee. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Wrong signal there. I guess, too, the general attitude about transferring people would be that if a foster care provider wanted someone transferred, generally, I would assume that that would be likely to occur because staffing is you know, the person providing that care is the staffer, and if there is a problem there, I wouldn't think we'd want to keep them in that home. Is that accurate? You know, and I understand there's some mitigating circumstances because for seniors you want some stability too, but the other side of that is you don't want a caregiver who doesn't want to be giving care to that individual providing it.
Mm-hmm. Senator Kinnaman, I think that the whole issue came up as a conflict in the first place because some people said that a personality difference, for instance, shouldn't be reason to make somebody move.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you're expecting the adult foster care providers to be fairly professional and to be able to manage, you know, a variety of people. And so the compromise was, you know, under certain circumstances, which is more than a personality conflict, you have a right to evict someone if you can't provide care or if they change. Part of the problem might be solved if in the beginning there's enough information so that people can make a good choice about what foster home a person might want to live in and have some, you know, acquaintanceship between the two people.
Okay. All right. You want to continue?
Yes. Mm-hmm. On page 4, we still have the provision that there must be a provider or certified resident manager or substitute caregiver on duty 24 hours a day. A couple changes the group made in licensing, that no license shall be issued or renewed prior to the completion of an inspection. And in a later section, it does say that there's a yearly licensing process. This is one of the issues that's in response. If you remember, a woman, Joy Patterson, who'd come to testify, and her mother had been killed in a bathtub in a foster home. This is one of the provisions that she specifically requested, that there be yearly inspections and licensing. And also the provision on page 4, starting at line 38, on the persons who are convicted of crimes or, you know, family are not allowed to work in a foster home.
Janice, is there currently a license fee?
A license fee, yes. Varies by...
But the $20 a bed is a new assessment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, what was that? The $20 a bed.
Let us go through the procedure. If you want to ask a question, would you come up?
That's in current statute.
Is current.
That's current
this
statute. Current what I'm going through is what we changed.
Thank you.
And trying to explain what we didn't, what the group changed. But current statute, yeah, it's 20. On page 5. The large X across the page is the private right of action.
That's okay.
On the top of page 6, this is language we did again take out the sole reference to Senior and Disabled Services Division, wrote in the department. As I discussed earlier, the committee may want to reconsider that. This is language that was in the original bill in terms of each facility getting a license report and the requirement that they would have to post it. And this has become very controversial in the entry or an equally prominent place. Some of the providers believe that of the opinion that they do not want to place that the inspection notice in the entry. Section 7 is...
The department shall.
Yes.
What was this in general agreement?
Providing the license.
Yes, the department.
Mm-hmm. That they would provide the license.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Section 7 is the replacement for the private right of action, in a sense. At the hearing, if you remember, we spent some time discussing what really is the problem here. And was it a problem with statute or, you know, enforcement? What this does is it sets up a procedure for complaint investigation by the department. And it sets up some different tiers in terms of severity of complaints. Starting out that if a department receives a complaint that alleges that a resident has been injured, abused, or neglected, and that their health or safety is in imminent danger, that has to be responded to, investigated to immediately. The next serious level is that there's a complaint that could result in injury, abuse, and again place the resident health or safety in imminent danger. That's a prompt. The promptly language is taken from current rules. The AAAs have been working with that language. We did add the immediate language. This again, to keep in mind, these are the AAAs, the people in the field who are going to be out doing the investigation. The department will set rules for the standards and procedures for the timelines for the investigation of complaints. There is an outside limit of 60 days. In no event shall the investigation exceed 60 days. That's the top of page 7. This is not to say that all investigations would take 60 days. This is the absolute outside. And SDSD is expected to come up with some more immediate, shall we say, timelines for the more serious types of complaints, but that would be left to rules.
Ms. Cody,
mm-hmm.
Would you come up, please? How long does an investigation usually take? It usually takes 60 days.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Mr. Chair, are you referring to the investigation
Yes.
at the local unit level?
Yeah.
As I understand from talking to Senior and Disabled Services, those investigations are averaging now 54 days at the local unit level.
54 days?
At the local unit level. But, Mr. Chair, that's only part of the issue because it's what happens after those investigations. Nothing can be done on those investigations till they are then sent to Central Office Senior and Disabled Services Division, which then reviews
them. What is that lag time?
Over the past year, that's been anywhere from the time it gets to Senior and Disabled Services till the time that action is taken, that an action being evidenced by some decision as to whether there should be a civil penalty or whatever. Over the last year and a half, that has, those can be 6 months to a year.
6 months?
6 months
in terms. 6 months in addition to the 54 days.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. There's been a significant lag time between the time at which a complaint is posited with central office and the time in which action has been taken on that complaint.
That's 234 days.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there have been several complaints that had to have been closed because it was too long a time period.
What would you suggest? I mean, ideally, what would be the proper time?
Well, Mr. Chair.
See, you have 60 days here in the bill.
Right.
Well, that's 60 days. Actually, it's 244 days as is now.
Mr. Chair, currently Senior and Disabled Services has indicated to us that they have revised their response system such that they are now able to respond to complaints coming into their office from the local units on a 42-day turnaround. That is, they now have restructured so that they are addressing complaints on a 42-day turnaround. They are still working, as I understand, on a significant backlog, so they are currently issuing civil penalties on incidents that happened last October and November.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Trill. When SDSD does the investigation and realize the situation is very grave, very serious, can they speed through that process, give it priority? Do they do that? Do they take action quickly when they need to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, yes, they can do that. If there is cooperation between the local unit in terms of alerting that there is a significant problem, if the local unit does a good, solid investigation and then turns that over to SDSD, I believe that there is an opportunity to take some action, but it takes a significant situation with a lot of people working together, and they do have that ability to respond.
Okay, and the group agreed to the 60 days, so, okay.
Mm-hmm.
If they want 222 days or 234 days, then, and they think that that's good time, then...
The outside limit is 60 days for the...
Yeah,
it can take no longer than 60 days for the investigation to occur. And then once the investigation report is completed, another 60 days to take the corrective action. Mm-hmm. On page 7, line 29, starts the notification language. And this mirrors we'll be dealing with later a nursing home enforcement bill. This language is similar in terms of notifying the complainant. You'll see that the language says the department shall cause a copy of the investigation report to be mailed within 7 days of the completion of the report to the complainant, the resident, the facility, the long-term care ombudsman. The reason the language says shall cause is because what this does is it means that the division itself doesn't have to do it. The AAAs could do that. It just means that they have to be, overseen. But this means that AAAs will very likely be mailing these notices, which lowers the overall fiscal impact as far as SDSD is concerned.
Do they have the personnel to do
in
that?
In the AAAs?
The thing is, I understand that have you done the budget for the AAAs?
Tomorrow.
Amazing.
No, not yet. I think it's not
this week. Mm-hmm. It's not this week. Mm-hmm. If they get cut,
we have agreement with on this portion.
Yeah. It's in the budget?
No, well,
we do SDSD's budget again tomorrow, I think.
Page 8, just current statute, we're amending that section. We can skip over to section 9, to page 9. Almost done here. talks about the exception. Right now there's a limit of one resident with nursing care needs. This says when an exception can be granted. And the original bill said if there's clear and convincing evidence that such an exception will not jeopardize the health, safety, or welfare of the resident, the group added, and that the provider is capable of meeting the additional care needs.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, they have to be.
The provider is capable. So they may not be capable of providing the care.
Well, SD, the department is granting the exceptions, so it's in the judgment of the department in terms of the capability.
Okay.
And in terms of these exceptions, the report will go to the Legislative Assembly. It originally was going to go to the Governor's Commission. Let me make sure. Again, current statute. So we go to page 10. Page 10, the civil penalty provisions. There are a number of different civil penalties in statute. This language has been through Ledge Council. A lot of our bills originally had subsequent referrals to judiciary because they're working on civil penalty. What we're doing now is just sending them to Ledge Council and they're writing in the appropriate language. Ledge Council changed it from punished by a civil penalty to subjected to the imposition of. The penalties are raised, the current ones, maximum of 100 goes up to 250 for a violation. A major change is for substantiated abuse going from 250 to 1,000. Again, some of the providers, I guess I should say that this is the group represented by Grover Simmons, feels that these civil penalties, the amount they're being raised to are very high. I need to say that in terms of what other states do, and we're talking substantiated abuse here, that this is not perceived to be an inordinately high penalty. There is another penalty that's added, the $500 for intentionally falsifying resident or facility records. That is an addition. You will notice it says 500. It does not say up to. That's another area the group had some discussion. The other penalties you noticed are up to an amount. This one is a flat 500. And a section that was deleted, you'll see again on page 10, lines 15 to 21. There was some discussion on that. It basically says that a civil penalty may not be imposed unless it's found on two consecutive surveys. Again, if we're going out and licensing, we only go out once a year to license. That means you could be going 2 years without having a civil penalty. So that's one of the reasons that section was deleted.
Yes.
So the Kenema has a question.
Uh-huh.
Who determines when a document's been intentionally falsified?
Intentionally, again, that's the department is in terms of imposing all the civil penalties. That's the judgment. They're the ones who have that authority. last section. The work rights starts on page 10.
One thing. Getting back to that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
If you intentionally falsify a resident's records or cause it to happen, isn't that a criminal offense?
It's been through Ledge Council. They didn't pick that up.
I guess it depends on what you want to call it. Mm-hmm. So they want to call it a civil penalty.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have civil penalties for things that could be referred to the district attorney for prosecution. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of interpretation, I guess. Okay, just curious.
Yeah. That's a good question. Uh-huh. Check that out.
Line 34, section 11 is a new section on the Bill of Rights. This was adapted from the rules. Extends over to page 11. Only a couple of changes here on line 8, which is item 14, on the personal clothing and belongings. The resident right said that they have the right to have a private, secure storage space, reasonable amount. Again, that was a request by some of the provider groups. And on lines 13 and 14 about a written agreement regarding the services to be provided, the provider must give 30 days written notice before any change in the rate. The temp here was not individual rates, but the rate schedule for the home. So that's why you have that change. And on lines 16 to 18, you have the sudden increase of level of care needs to be consistent with the earlier amendment. I missed it. Might ask some of the people who worked on the bill if there's anything major that has been left out.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Kenemer.
Just a comment on the patient rights. Number 8 is limited to chemical or physical restraints except as ordered by a physician. Earlier, I noticed we also had Christian Science practitioner.
Oh, right. That should be changed to be consistent. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just for the purposes of having the bill before us, I'll move the amendments in the mocked-up bill, and then if we want to work on them, we can.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Phillips.
I'd like to go through now that we actually have an amended bill in front of us and kind of work on some of these things. I've highlighted three sections. Interestingly enough, the first one is that section 3 on the second page of your bill and of the amended bill that Senator Crowe just moved. I find that language terribly awkward. First of all, we're charging an agency with developing rules and then requiring them that these two courses we've decided, the first one will be done within 60 days. Well, interestingly enough, if they're developing rules on satisfactory study, perhaps there'll be 2, 3, 5, 10 courses or continuing education or a variety of other things. Whether you need 60 days to commence the first one, I believe it to be poor legislative structure to determine what we want agencies to do and rule before they go through rulemaking hearings and determine the best way to do it. So I would suggest in there a conceptual amendment, actually starting on line 6, where we call for two courses and say courses, with parentheses around the S on courses. And then if you go down to line 7, I just delete that whole thing that talks about the first course shall be completed in a period of time until line 8, or through line 8, till line 9, that period. Just take that right out of there. So essentially what you're going to have is satisfactory course or courses of study approved by the department after consultation with the providers, residents, advocates. The department shall adopt rules, standard government content. So they'll go through a process to develop what the best way to do this will be and when to do it. I ran through that quickly. I'd be glad to go over it again if you'd like.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I think the purpose of the awkward wording was to say that there ought to be some training immediately before people are put on the job, and then more extensive training later. And that language does that. I think if you leave that language out, it doesn't say that exactly. Would you, Senator Phillips, would you envision that the rules could say that anyway, so you wouldn't need it in there? Is that what you're saying?
I would say, obviously, I would expect the courses to come back and say, this is going to be your short-term need, long-term, this is your continuing education. The department, if you have a running, competent department of rulemaking, which I would hope the state has, that would be the process they would do rather than the legislature picking a 60-day and 2 months period. I'm not sure that's immediately enough. I would say, given the comment that we heard about this videotape, maybe within 14 days they should have reviewed that and have written sign off that they reviewed it. This kind of arbitrariness to it bothers me. If to get at your concern, you want to say courses of study addressing immediate and long-term needs, that's fine. But I think that's as far as a directive as we should to be on some of these things. That I just think it from a purpose of a record, it's clearer and more distinct.
Mm-hmm. But if our intent is clearly understood that in having the two tests, we want something there so that some training goes to those people who are initially on the job.
Well, I would say, Senator, that you should say course and then parentheses around an S, courses, so that you don't limit yourself necessarily to two. It may be that you want one that's all-encompassing, and once you've taken it, you learn it for life. I can't imagine a situation like that, but let's assume it could happen. Or that they say, you know, really, once a year you should take a refresher course or whatever, which would mean, you know, if you worked at a place for 4 years, you're actually going to take four courses.
But the problem is that you've heard situations where people have come in to work, and we have requested that kind of thing before, and somehow it gets extended and extended and extended, and people get hurt because they don't know how to lift